And welcome. Hey, patrons. And actually, Twitch folks are here, too. We're opening it up. This is the first of our... We should have a fancy name for it. The Socialist Debate Symposium Hour. Leo Panitch debates two capitalists. David Griscom has witnessed this debate. I will be viewing it cold with you. But welcome, everybody. We won't be doing this full thing on Twitch. So Twitch people, if probably about 20 minutes will be going to just the Patreon link. So patreon.com/leftreckoning if you want to watch this. And we'll also put the audio up for members. But David, give people a little taste of what we'll be watching this evening.
Yeah. So this debate is an interesting one. One, because it's Panitch essentially against two people. And in practice, he's against three people because the moderator is just terrible. I'm just going to have to be honest about that. The debate itself, I'm also going to say, and not to undersell it, but it's a very bad debate because it's such a hostile environment that nobody's recognizing or like sort of wrestling with what Leo Panitch is saying. And they basically want him to say that, this policy is a socialist policy, which is very much against Panitch's like understanding of socialism. And we'll get into why that is in a little bit. But it's a very interesting debate because you do learn a lot from Panitch. And it's also interesting to see what the other people bring up as counter arguments. I'll say Yarn Brooks, who is one of the people that Panitch is debating, is a very odd fellow. He's debated Ben Burgess a few times on his channel. And I have a lot of personal animosity to this guy just because I remember one time when I was doing those country music segments on Ben's show, logging in on time and sort of sitting in the waiting room while Ben had to argue with this guy, Yarn. And the guy basically wouldn't get off the phone and was just going on about how he's worried that Ben Burgess and like the socialists were going to come into his house and like steal his like television. Ugh. Right. And I'm just sitting there. It was like a beautiful Saturday afternoon or something like that. I wanted to be out and doing other things and having to just listen to this asshole. So there's some bad blood already, but it's a fun talk. It'll be interesting.
So here this is, we will share this. This is from the Institute of Arts and Ideas. Or of art and ideas, which I think David will be into about half of that. We don't need the art. I will pick this up from the very beginning.
Is it a mistake to imagine that equality can be engineered by socialist planning? Should we be skeptical of those wrapped in fine ideals, or is there a form of socialism that can deliver on the dream? That's what we're going to be discussing today. So here on the panel, we have Leo Panitch, who is Emeritus Professor of Political Science at York University in Toronto. On my left here, we have Aaron Brooke, who is Chairman of the Ayn Rand Institute. And on my far left, literally anyways, Kemi Badenoch, who is a Conservative MP for Saffron Walden. So Leo, over to you.
Saffron Walden.
In one of Barbara Kingsolver's remarkable novels, a woman asks her lover, "Did you ever dream you could fly?" And he replies, "Not when I was sorting pecans all day." And she presses on and says, "But really, did you ever fly in your dreams?" And he answers, "Only when I was close to flying in real life. Your dreams, which you hope for, and all that, is not separate from your life. It grows right out of it." Terry Eagleton, the great British philosopher, who wrote in a volume I edited on necessary and unnecessary utopias back in 2000, that the only authentic image of the future is the failure of the present in its inability to redeem glimpses of our potential afforded by our own experience. And if you'll allow me finally...
Not to do this all the time, but you could see Yarn is already pissed that that Leo Panitch is trying to give this very artful and spiritual understanding of... be setting us up for something, and Yarn is like losing his mind if you watch closely.
Yeah, and I feel like it mentions Stalinism, like is it the first word?
Yeah, In the YouTube description, the first word is like about Stalin and gulags.
Right.
Absolutely.
This comes straight out of the previous two quotations. Marx once said, socialism is not a state of affairs to which reality will have to adjust itself, but a real movement which abolishes the present state of things. So just to make it clear where I'm coming from, socialism is not a model. It's not an economic model. It's not an abstract utopia. It's not Thomas More. It's not even the much greater Robert Owen. Socialism is always the warm element in human life, which is aiming to unleash human democratic, sympathetic reciprocity in our lives. It is certainly not, as is most commonly and mistakenly claimed, state versus market. I'll stop there.
That's interesting. Okay. You're on.
So the first thing that comes to mind when I saw the title, Socialist Dreams, is nightmares.
He's a creative guy.
God damn.
Because that's the only thing humanity has experienced when it has adopted socialist dreams. It's experienced nightmare.
All right. Okay.
It's not just that socialism has failed everywhere that it has been tried, from the gulags to Mao to Venezuela right now, to the kibbutz in Israel, but that ideologically, as an ideal, I think socialism is an inherently corrupt ideal. It is based on an inherently corrupt moral philosophy and therefore has to fail because it is antagonistic to human nature and antagonistic to proper proper respect for ethics. Socialism is based on the philosophical notion, not that we should be nice to one another, not of reciprocity, which is the hallmark of capitalism, reciprocity, but
totally
of the idea that the individual should be sacrificed to the group. And you can fill in what the group constitutes. You can fill in if it's the proletarian or if it's some other form of group. Market. But it's the idea that the individual at the end of the day does not matter. That what matters is some kind of social utility, some kind of well-being, some kind of mystical form, platonic form of the good that is not actually attainable for any individual, but somehow we have as a group. And to me, anytime you want to sacrifice...
Oh, Panish's is body language.
You do, human sacrifice.
Is what?
His body language.
Always done. That is evil. That is the essence of what evil means. So I oppose socialism not only because it obviously has been a dramatic and overwhelming failure when practiced, but because it has failed because it is so incompatible with human morality, with the strive towards individual virtue.
That reminds me like that sort of, it's incompatible. It's like the sort of fundamentalism where you talk about Islam and the Quran, and actually if you read it really closely, it's not compatible with democracy. So like, never mind the practice. I can find out ideologically that this is bad. And go ahead.
No, I think that's a good point. And this is why, you know, spoiler alert, this debate is going to be very frustrating for a lot of reasons. It's one thing that I really appreciate about Panish's opening statement, and then what he's going to develop later, is that, you know, he's just going to tell, what his theories are very clearly with the hope and recognition that people will get it despite what the other people are saying. And like, you know, just to say it again very briefly, like this point that Panish makes, that it's not just this, socialism is not just like, oh, this set of socialist policies, is really, really important. If you're a socialist and you look at the history of the 20th century, right? Like, think about what happens in the Soviet Union, right? You have the socialists, right? in control of the state. And even in that moment, they're not able to implement socialism. What does that mean? Right. That's why Lenin, you know, the one of the first things that they do is implement the new economic policy, which uses markets, uses, you know, capitalist relations to industrialize large parts of the society. Right. And, you know, Panish is of the opinion that that whole process and what follows later, you know, the Soviet Union was a failure. Right. But the point is that, and what the bigger point is here is that, even if you're able to, you know, use this kind of model, like the insurrectionist model, right, that like you just take over the state and then you call the shots, like even if you have that power, you're not able to do it, because socialism is something very, very different from just like, okay, here's like the tax rate, we're just going to mess with this a little bit and blah, 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 right?
It's very but David, much, have you heard of modern monetary theory?
Don't get me started. Please, that'll be a whole other question. And we'll do it sometime soon. Anyways, we should let them talk.
And with the focus that we have had in the West since the Enlightenment on individual flourishing, individual freedom, individual liberty, which I think is what the West,
we get it.
That's and now, beautifully, globally, is essence of a...
Can I just say, like, words that end in L-Y, adjatives, like, just, like... The amount that I notice people on the right particularly lean on them, and they're not good, folks.
Civilize of civilization, the idea of the sanctity of the individual, and placing the individual first as the end. Thank you.
Thank you. Kemi.
Thank you, Marianne. I think there's something in that, Yaron, that I can agree with, because I'm someone who does believe in individual liberty and personal freedom. That's what my philosophy is about. And I don't think that it is compatible with socialism. But I'm coming at it from a different angle, because I've actually been through it. Where I lived, we had socialism. They didn't call it socialism. I grew up in Nigeria. And this, I think, is one of the greatest truths. You know, with apologies to Chris McCrory, who wrote The Usual Suspects.
No, it gets good.
That the greatest trick that socialism ever achieved was making people think that it hadn't been tried properly yet. And that's why we keep having the conversation.
It's an interesting
about
formulation.
Even though we have seen time and time again what the results are. We've seen, in fact, two countries split themselves in two, by that I mean Germany and Korea, where they tried the two different models. And the model that always, the socialist model, always ended up with people trying to get out and getting shot for doing so, literally wanting to escape it. And I think that that is what you will always have with socialism. But the question which we were given was, can it ever work? And actually, this is probably very controversial. I do think in a very, very limited set of circumstances, which I'll elaborate on later, you can have it, but I don't think that you will like what it is that you see. And I think that the tragedy of some of the discussions we're having now is that there's a new generation that's never really experienced it, certainly in this country or in the US, and they have an idealistic sort of utopian view of what it could be if only people just got it right, which is where my own personal experience comes from.
Yeah, let's just send people to Nigeria and they can see what socialism is like.
And I think
Leo has a great retort to this.
Nigeria wasn't socialist, that what the problem with it was corruption. One of the greatest tragedies of African, when African countries got their independence, was that it was in the 60s when socialism and that, you know, philosophy was in its heyday. And almost universally, every African country chose a socialist model, whether it was Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, whether it was Kwame Nkrumah in Nigeria, in Ghana, even in Nigeria, in Senegal, everywhere, it was the ideal that they looked for. And it caused so...
It's like these experiments played out in a vacuum, like, okay, yeah. Capitalism on this side of the line and socialism on this side of the line, go. It started with the same building blocks and everything. Unbelievable. Like this is a like a very certain, like the view of history, like you can see why it's sort of it's great propaganda, because it makes sense on an intuitive level if you have no historical grounding in the situations at all. Like, it's like they just did the experiment. Oh, God. Like, A-B testing.
So many problems where if you look in Asia with other countries, they didn't necessarily go down that path. And what happens when, and I know Leo says it isn't about state versus markets.
I think also people need to read Vincent Bevan's The Jakarta Method, yeah. His most recent book on the amount of mass killing and ideologically driven murder it took to create these sort of political environments. But
I would just add, like, on that vein too, this is like the same thing we were talking about last week with like Stephen Crowder, right? And those people who are like, well, what if you didn't consider like this, right? Or, you know, when we were talking about like the statistical models that right. Stephen Crowder was trying to say prove COVID is not a real thing, right? And then like, no, actually they have. Just one author, you know, off the top of my head, like read France Fanon on exactly what happens right. with these post-colonial states, immediately after independence, right? It's like these things have been very, very well, they've been thought through, and the argument is very clear on them, which is that in these countries you have what is called a national bourgeoisie that creates relationships with international capital and then uses their connections with the state to be able to extract as much value from the natural resources of the country. So the profits going out of the country in general, and then a few people are getting enriched. I don't understand any kind of conception that would think of that as socialist, except for an extremely childish view, mm-hmm. Which is that socialism is when the government is big and capitalism is when the government is small. Because if you're going to use the United States or the United Kingdom as examples of capitalist success, you have to reckon with the fact that these are two of, are huge bureaucratic states, right? These are states that they're very big in that sense, right? But I would never go so far as to say the United States is socialist or the United Kingdom is socialist. But I don't know. But that's like what life is like in this confused funhouse mirror.
It really sucks though, because like this is an institute of arts and ideas, right? Yeah. Ostensibly, people come to this thinking, okay, I got fucking an hour that I can use to better my understanding of like how we do economics on the planet. And you have two perspectives that are just brainless, basically. Yeah. And oh man, and her way of saying, like, as if nobody had considered what you're talking about, it makes people not feel any anxiety to look into that, which they should, right? It basically says like, oh no, me and the Ayn Rand Institute guy, we looked into this, and basically, yeah, it's
yeah, we didn't.
Yeah. Here we go.
Quite interested to hear more about that, because that's not the socialism which we were taught in schools and that's in the textbooks.
Well, I wonder why.
When you do have the government being the owner of every single thing and being in charge of everything, it does foster corruption. It gives them an unlimited power, which is so dangerous, and it crushes the individual.
Okay, so what we're going to discuss to start with is whether we can achieve equality through some form of centralized planning, which is generally what socialism is about. Now, my worry is that you have almost defined socialism out of existence in your pitch at the beginning by saying it's not about
sounds like
Marxism.
Destiny.
It's not about state versus market. It's purely a question of affinity. But, I mean, we all feel affinity with each other. We can all be socialists, but we need to talk about socialism in action, socialism in public policy, socialism via governments. And so if you've defined that out of existence, how can we even talk about it?
Well, I hardly defined Marx out of existence, and it was Marx who said that socialism is about, as John Stuart Mill, the full realization of individual capacity. The notion that Marx or any socialist believes that the existing state, the pre-capitalist state, or the existing state in the capitalist society, is the institutional structure through which people would be able to realize their democratic collective potentials, is absurd. No one would claim this. Indeed, in not only the Marxist tradition, but in the social democratic one, in the liberal one, for that matter, the state is seen as an imposition on society, not as an expression of it. So let's then go back to this question of central planning. central planning was introduced in capitalist societies during World War I. It was the mobilization of all resources by the state in order to prosecute the war. These were capitalist states, although pre-capitalist ruling classes, landed classes, were still powerful within them, and in my view, that was an element in what produced the war, although obviously capitalist competition for colonies, not least in Africa, which most of which were secured and turned basically into capitalist societies as colonies and remained as such in Nigeria after independence, as Shell Oil indicates. That's where central planning
is. That's a good dig.
It is true that Lenin looked with admiration on the German post.
Subtle, too.
But he did not look with admiration on German central planning with its direction of labor, its conscription of trade unions and labor, etc. If you want to understand how that evolved in the Soviet Union, and it was not something that was a model that they imposed, you have to understand it in the context of the Civil War, the invasion of the Soviet Union by the forces that were victorious in World War I, and it was an unfortunate response to that civil war, and I think, as Isaac Deutscher pointed out, the great historian of Stalin, the journalist for The Economist here in Britain, what happened during the course of the war was that the
Incidentally, do you have a read on Deutscher? I know Hitchens like recommended his books.
Yeah, I mean he's written a few big biographies on Stalin, and also believe Trotsky as well.
I just wasn't sure because the Economist. Affiliation doesn't inspire hope itself.
Well, you know, we could maybe later, but this is something that is very interesting if you read like the early reporting of the Soviet Union in English press from people who were there. There was a lot of positivity and excitement around it, you know, which I've always seen as a plus, though I have seen right wingers, and I think Yarn actually might do this later in the debate. Make the argument that it's like only like, you know, these intellectuals who are separate from society who like get excited about these things. Mm. But no, there was a lot of positive reporting, which is very much needed to debunk a lot of the nonsensical like lies that then became. It was an amazing example of like collective amnesia, the way that people in the West started to think about the Soviet Union, right? It happens at first and there's a lot of excitement or at least interest. And then within 15 years, the narrative not only is chasing like people's like orientation toward it, but just on simple facts that right. have been reported in like, you know, the major American papers 15 years ago now have been completely, you know, blown up with these, you know, horror stories and, you know, many of them fabricated.
Yeah. And all of a sudden Nigeria is socialist.
Anarcho-syndicalists turned out more popular than the Bolsheviks when you had competing parties.
But did
parties were done away with because it was never thought by socialists that once workers had been won to socialism, they might no longer support it. And they responded disastrously, by closing off freedom of expression, competing parties, etc., were criticized immediately for this, most famously by Rosa Luxemburg. This is why she's a hero of the democratic socialist left. Not only do you not have liberty when you don't have competing parties, freedom of association, what especially matters in a socialist society is workers develop, ordinary people, developing the capacities to govern. And you can't do that where you have bureaucracy closing that off.
So, yes, the
crack existed in socialism. It was resolved by 1924. You're quoting from Leonard Cohen, he's thinking of this. There is a crack in everything. Let's ring the bells that still can ring. But he thinks, and I think, there was also a crack in social democracy. Let me just finish with this. What Eagleton says, it is the failure of the present in terms of redeeming our possibilities. This is what redeems the socialist vision. And the attempt by us socialists, as democratic socialists, to find a way for that not to happen again. And it is, as opposed to what we just heard, the appalling failure the appalling failure of neoliberal global capitalism to realize most people's potential, as we see in the way the gloss is off of it everywhere. The tragedy is that
I want to go back over that Yaron Brooks handshake.
Off of it everywhere. The tragedy, of course, is that the failure of Soviet socialism, much more importantly, the way in which social democracy, the Third Way, Blairism, all the European social democratic parties embrace neoliberal globalization, leaves them now bereft in terms of speaking to their own constituency.
I just want to make a quick... Dakota Heppner says, as hilarious as this debate is, I actually learned a lot from Panitch in it. And I mean, that's been my impression so far too. And it's just nice to have like somebody who has a grasp of what they're actually talking about. And it's annoying to have a moderator, like you said, who is just so unprepared to actually like go somewhere with that. Like she's just like, but what policies? Like, has it actually happened though? And it's like, I don't know how it's so complicated. The feudalism, capitalism, and mercantilism thing, that should be clear enough for people, right? Like, elements of that existed when it was still the fucking king telling everyone what to do, right? Like, and it wasn't, like, and so pockets of socialism can exist in a world that is completely controlled by capitalists. This should not be that hard.
Yeah, and I mean... Yeah, and I think that's a good point from Dakota there, and that's why we wanted to do it, is because it's a very frustrating debate. I remember when I watched it the first time, it's very difficult to watch on your own because you're just getting pissed off at like the particularly the way that the moderator treats this. Because what's frustrating with me about the way the moderator treats this is that, you know, Panitch is very unique in his ability to paint the picture well. He's an incredible writer. He's very he's very kind, but he's a pugnacious like thinker and debater. He's not somebody who's just going to sit and let somebody spout nonsense in front of him. So that's why we appreciate him. But you don't have to know Panitch or be very well versed in his work, though you probably should if you're going to be a moderator of a debate with him. But this is honestly is a major current within socialist thought and writing. And as Matt was saying earlier, you know, to put on this debate in this kind of like, you know, academic way, and then to put forward such a trivial conception of what socialism versus capitalism is very exhausting.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to cut you short there, but I want to ask.
We're going to go for another 5 more minutes, then we're going to kick the Twitchies off, and you can either go watch, give them an argument, or you can become patrons and continue with us here.
So we've had now 101 years since socialism was first introduced in government.
Yes.
Well, if you count from 1917 onwards. In what country, in that century, has there been successful... democratic socialism with, as you say, freedom of speech.
Well, we're not talking about
because it's been tried.
An interesting question would be, in which countries was it like parliamentarily excluded, like by fascists or dictators? Like that'd be a question with an actual answer to it.
All over the world. So where has it worked?
It isn't a model that's been imposed. It's an outgrowth of particular societies in particular times in conflict internally and in conflict externally. You say,
but that's true.
You say socialism
ideology
in Cuba didn't work. Did capitalism in Cuba work? Socialism in Cuba didn't come out of a model. It came out of the failure of capitalism in Cuba. And what happened to socialism in Cuba cannot be understood from beyond the fact that it sits on the periphery of the greatest empire in world history, right? Did socialism in Mozambique work? No. But one has to understand that, obviously, in terms of the conditions of Mozambique, its social resources, its place in the world.
I can point to
100 capitalist societies which we could say fail in Aaron's terms, in terms of liberty. Well, look at the number of capitalist dictatorships in history. Indeed, my fear today with Trump, with the xenophobia that people are being appealed to, is that just as it was said in the 1930s, he who speaks of fascism without speaking of capitalism should remain silent. I fear today that he who speaks of capitalism without speaking of fascism should remain silent. It may be we will turn to socialism because the alternative, in the name of individual freedom, is to treat everyone else as an asset.
So you're basically saying it's the least worst, okay, Kemi?
Not necessarily. It's what we can do to realize our potential once we free ourselves of being treated as assets by people with property.
But where has it actually worked? In a democratic way, with freedom of expression.
It's not a model that works.
I'd like to come back on a couple of things that Leo has said. There's a general conflation between capitalism and free markets. They are not the same thing. One of them is a method of ownership. The other one is a
myth. Like, free market. People conflate capitalism and markets, yes. The conflation between capitalism and free markets, no, I think that's actually fine. Like, if you want to use those interchangeably, because free markets don't exist. It's a capitalist, like, you know, talking point.
Method of exchange. You can have free markets without having the capitalism if you want. And for example, if you look at the John Lewis partnership, for instance, Waitrose, that's not a capitalist model. All the employees have a share in the business and they all have a share of the profits. The co-op down the road is another example. There are loads of different types of models that you can have while still having a free market system. So the issue around capitalism, what Leo, I think, is calling capitalism is what I would call corporatism, where it's about...
Oh, that's the... I love that move. That's my capitalism. Favorite. Or crony capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So much of capitalist, like apologetics are just rebranding exercises.
Yeah.
Right? Capitalism is free markets. Capitalism is, is good, but crony capitalism is bad, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. You see that in the surveillance capitalism too.
That's another bad one.
Yeah,
is the small business, you having a bakery, being able to buy and sell your own goods. That's capitalism too. So when you talk about, for instance, Shell operating,
the ability to exploit labor that absolutely needs to work for you in order to provide for them, that's capitalism.
In Nigeria, it's something I lived there when all of this was happening, when Ken Saro-Wiwa was killed. Shell was basically an extension of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. They worked together. The people had nothing to do with what was going
that's
on.
That's right.
The price of oil was set by the government, which is, price controls. It's, it's a tenet, it's socialism that you have to fix. It's about price fixing, price controls to make sure that people don't overcharge. And all that happened...
Amazing. I mean,
price globally went up, and the Nigerian government took money...
Like, we have to play them just because people would accuse us of, not being fair, if we didn't let them play. But really, it's just nonsensical. It's the argument you already expect, right?
Well, that's what's interesting about it is like just the pattern recognition. Like when you expose yourself enough to these debates, you realize that there's not really a whole lot of new arguments under the sun.
Well, because they're not engaging on the same plane.
Right.
Like, honestly, it's like, and it's not even just like, oh, they're speaking, different like philosophical languages. It's like one person, Panitch, is like taking a philosophy that takes history, society, class consciousness, class politics, and conflict into account. And one is just this extreme, like the thing that's funny about the capitalists like Yarn and Kemi and this moderator is that they're basically accusing like Leo of being, so ethereal and like, abstract in his arguing. But Leo is the only one who's really dealing with the world as it is. Well, they're very much, operating from this abstraction of reality. Like here's the free market versus here is, socialism.
Yeah. And I don't know enough economic history to know what presidents have engaged in price controls, but like Nixon very famously engaged in a lot of price controls. I don't know. Does that make him a socialist? Did we have somebody should learn Hunter S. Thompson.
and just to turn our fire, socialists make this mistake sometimes too. And I understand why it can be rhetorically nice to say things like socialism is building roads, right? It's like, well, that's not really a great argument. Were the Roman emperors like radical socialists? No, I mean, I understand what you're trying to say. There's like, this is something that we're doing, for communal good potentially without having it be an exchange that you have to use it every time you use the road. Right? I understand why people use that, but that plays into this very confused notion of what socialism is versus what capitalism is. And Panitch's like historical argument that's very much rooted, like, honestly, I don't want this to get lost, actually, because he makes a distinction that's really smart and important. And that's why we talk so much about state theory on this show. He's like, socialism is not something that can like sit on top of society, but something that like grows out of it. And what he means by that is that, you know, the bourgeois state, the capital state, is something that, you know, honestly, in a lot of ways, like Yaron is going to argue in a second, it sits on us. It imposes its will on us. It does that through the legal system, policing, and all these other things, right? That this is the way that you have to live. It orients your way of thinking, your way of interacting with each other, right? This is, you know, that's what the state does. And this was something that's sitting on, like, the working class. It's sitting on our development. It's sitting on society in general. And what Panitch is talking about is the state actually being an outgrowth of society. So, you know, people, you know, who are in a situation where, you know, they're controlling their own labor in a workplace are able to have outgrowths so that we can all interact with each other in a, you know, communitarian way, because that is something that will be necessary to have a state. People who think that, you know, we're just going to abolish the state and wall off these worker co-ops, that would be a disaster. To give you a reason why, it'd be like, you know, if you're a factory upriver, it might make a lot of sense for you to bump all your to pump all your toxic waste or, you know, pollution or whatever downriver, right? Because it goes downstream and it doesn't affect you and it will ruin that community, right? You need to have a mediation, but it would be a very different mediation than what we have today, where, a big capitalist corporation is doing that in search of profit, and a bourgeoisie, the political class that runs our government and our system says, okay, well, we'll just, we're going to basically allow you to do that. We'll either look the other way or we'll put some kind of ineffective, you know, tax on you or whatever, right? But still allow this exploitation to continue. That's an example of it sitting on top of society, right? Versus the a different kind of potential. Anyways, like the reason this debate is so frustrating sometimes is because he's giving these kind of rich examples and they just, you know, get lost for her to say, oh, price fixing is socialism.
Yeah. All right. Twitch folks, patreon.com/leftreckoning. If you want to catch up with us, and we will see you on Thursday. All right. So it's just us YouTubers. We'll continue here.
The price of oil, which was mainly used by the wealthy because they're the ones who had the cars, they're the ones who had generators and so on. It always
socialists.
Has perverse incentives where there will still be a top class of people, whether you have capitalism or not, you bring the socialism in, and still there's a ruling class, as we saw with Stalin and Lenin, a ruling class that still manages to be above everyone else. So I'm very suspicious of it. I'm also very interested in Leo's definition of socialism, which seems to be able to morph and move. It's very ethereal, and, you know, we can't really grasp it. It's something, it's more of an emotion rather than a definition.
Okay, easy, Ben Shapiro.
That out, that it can never ever be tried, because anyone who tries it gets it wrong. Whether they call it, if they don't call it socialism, as we had in...
She's not listening to what he's saying. Anyone who tries it. How does one person try socialism?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a model. Then he's going to say it again, you know?
Africa, then it hasn't really been tried. Or as we had with National Socialism in Germany.
Oh, of
course.
It's like 10 minutes of this dumbass shit.
We'll go a little bit faster.
The same results over and over. Individuals being squashed and crushed. And the idea is more important than the people. And that's why I will never...
Hitler, who, you know, got to power and said... all these people in this, I forget what, blanket on the German parliament, but all the socialists, no, you're done. Yeah, the Reichstag, I just can't be part of it.
That's why I will never subscribe to it. And when you talk about, you know, you said the appalling failure of neoliberalism to realize individual potential. Where else in the world is individual potential realized more so than in the West, to the point where millions of people from all over the world are desperately trying to come here because this is where they feel that their ambitions and their individual potential can be most fulfilled. And that is what they say when they get off the boat, when they get off the plane. It's sad the way we talk about immigration as just, you know, the, you know, there's people just coming for economic benefits. It's not just that. This is not a dormitory where people come to work and make money. There's a lot more about what we have to offer. And it is about that individual liberty and personal freedom.
And the great British cuisine, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, like, for some immigrants that I'm sure they want to come and just, you know, express themselves fully. I think others maybe have other factors that are kind of pushing them towards America.
I mean, plenty of people are attracted to living in London, you know, who might not be born in the United Kingdom. Some of them are coming there because they need to work and to live and to survive. Some people are coming there for maybe the reason that she's saying. Some other people are going there because they know that this is the closest that they can get to imperial power, and that if they want to be able to utilize those benefits,
exactly,
that they need to uproot their lives and move to London.
Yeah, yeah. If you lived in Rome or Roman times, you'd want to be in Rome.
London too, especially like modern London. How it's very much like a playground of international ruling class in a way that is really incredible.
I was fortunate. I mean, this is probably too big of a tangent, but I was fortunate enough to stay in Kensington for a study abroad program. And people like look up Kensington. That's a rich place. just the cars just lined. Like, I haven't seen this in New York. I know there's some rich areas in like Brooklyn and whatever, but like I've never seen just every car is a Jaguar or up. Like $100,000 or more. And yeah, it's all just a playground for money. And, I mean, of course, New York is too, with the giant towers.
Well, it's money and power too, is what I'm saying.
It's not just,
oh, this is a fun place to spend my money. It's like, I'm coming here because I'm representing or I control a lot of interest in whatever country I'm coming from.
Right.
And I'm coming here to utilize and flex my muscle for whatever purposes, right? You know.
Yeah.
Do not rush to socialist states. Any state that has done it, there's no one beating their doors down to go and live in Cuba or Venezuela or North Korea or any of those places. And for me, look at the evidence. Look at the evidence. I think that's all you need to do to know that this is something that can't work.
But Yaron, surely, and there doesn't seem to be any place in your ideology for fairness and between people, because not everybody is born with the same
just baby concepts.
Yeah.
At the Institute for Arts and Ideas.
Intelligence with the same attributes, with the same abilities. And, you know, the great thing about socialism, surely, is that at least they can
get a
decent education, they can get decent healthcare, they can lead a reasonable life.
Hannah's just shaking his head at this, by the way. Because, not because he's against those things, obviously, but because, you know, she's doing the thing again, right?
Yeah.
At least they can get a decent education, they can get decent healthcare, they can lead a reasonable life.
So you go to some public schools, particularly in the poorest parts of England and the poorest parts of the United States, I don't think you would call the education the kids get there decent.
Well, actually, in some of the poorest parts of London, you get some of the best schools, like Newham.
Maybe I should argue about London, but certainly in the United States, that's not the case. Public education
is a massive failure.
Oof. Well, she just doesn't know what she's talking about. Like, there's some good charter schools. Like that's your rejoinder for the Anne Rand guy.
Public education somehow is a big failure.
Like the Ayn Rand guy somehow saying, yeah, America has shitty schools, which not expecting that from him. And her response is, but what about charter schools? Like this is like, what's that 80s movie with the sportscast that becomes an anchor? I forget. Broadcast News or something like that. Oh. But like, just like not, no, not, this is, why did you get this job?
Yeah, charter schools have improved things, but charter schools is exactly what
the
nation would argue against.
But they're still free and publicly provided.
Yes, and I think we could improve dramatically over that.
Charter schools are socialism, by the way.
Wait.
This is an insane world. Yeah. No, charter schools are, because obviously, I mean, Yaron is, you know, give him credit. He is like that much of a psycho. You know, that he is, you know, against public education, which is, I'm sorry. There are questions, you know, there are things that we need to do regarding that system, but it's probably one of the most popular achievements of like any democratic society. I mean, they're going all the way back to pre-capitalist society, to go back to like Platonist societies. Right.
Yeah.
In societies, but if you go back to, you know, to the Greek ideas, like, you know, education for the public is critical for democracy. you know, obviously in their context, who a citizen is, blah, blah. I don't mean to get caught up in that.
Well, I'd also just say it's like, it's the not all the important thing about school. They just stress it like it's just an ideological conformity machine, but it also brings you in contact with people in your community like nothing else, like absolutely nothing else.
But that's why they're, I mean, that's why they're so, so afraid of it.
Yeah.
But it's actually, anyways, it's amazing that this guy is so, so far into like this capitalist ideology that he's against charter schools, which are an incredible capitalist innovation.
Hilarious.
Essentially, like, you know, clandestinely, like, privatize an already existing public good.
Exactly. Remove it for more and more public control.
Make them free. Don't make them publicly provided. But let me. But I have to comment on this. On this neoliberalism's failure. Not that I'm a neoliberalist, because I think they're way too moderate in their support of markets. But I mean,
she likes that.
Look around the world today, and see darkness. Is to have shades, to be wearing shades. I travel all over the world. I've spoken in 60 different countries. When I go around the world, when I go to Eastern Europe,
they do wear shades because of the way the sun is blaring through the atmosphere that's been destroyed by capitalism.
Asia, or I go to China, or you go to Vietnam, or you go to any of these countries, what you're seeing is that the creation of markets, the ability to have free markets, even in limited circumstances, brings up
limited free markets.
Out human potential. People are so hungry to be free as individuals, so hungry to be left alone from the state dictating every single aspect of their lives. And as a consequence, over a billion people extreme poverty over the last 30 years. And you can ignore that. You can pretend it didn't happen. But globalization has brought more wealth to the world, has helped poverty, the poor, more than any other theoretical abstract system in human history. Over a billion people over the last 30 years have come out of extreme poverty. There's a middle class today in India and in China that did not exist 30 years ago. 30 years ago, 30% of the planet lived on under $2 a day. Today, the number is under 9%. Now, that should be something we should be celebrating and asking the question, how did this happen? This is indeed a beautiful thing. None of it happened because of foreign aid. None of it happened because of the exploitation of Marxist ideology.
Socialism.
We already had that. It's indeed the rejection of that Marxist ideology. It's the rejection of central planning. It's the rejection of the idea of the proletarian that has brought this around.
You going to say something?
I mean, I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but it's funny. I'm sure they'll bring it up in a second, or maybe they won't. The China and the India example, right? Because
they rejected central planning.
They're bizarre. Like, I mean, how is it, like, if Nigeria is socialist, right? Then India is socialist. If China, for fuck's sake, is not socialist, and Nigeria somehow, right? It's like, you know, and I understand how they would prepare themselves to wiggle out of that. But like, you know, depending on how you feel about the question, is like China actually socialist or whatever, is almost irrelevant at this point.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
By the definition that these people are using for these things, it's absurd to use the like poverty reduction that's happened over the past century, you know, without recognizing that the two prime examples of that are India and China. And then you need to start looking into what those political models are again. I'm not even saying anything about countries being socialist, because I'm very much on the panic side of this like way of thinking about it. But if they're doing their thing, it's absurd for them to try to like flex their muscle about how great free market capitalism is and then use the gains of China and India.
Right. It's hilarious.
It's the fact that Deng Xiaoping in China, as evil of a bastard that he was willing to say, look, it worked in Hong Kong. Maybe we should try this in the area around Hong Kong and see what happens. We'll just leave them alone. And when you leave people alone, when you leave people free, then they create things that exceed our imagination, because you are liberating the human potential. And that is true. If you go back 250 years ago, 95% of humanity lived on $2 a day or less. Imagine your own lives on $2 a day or less. People tell me, you know, we have a lot of anxiety in life today. Think about living where you're growing your own food and half your children are dying before age 10. That is the world before capitalism, before free markets. Capitalism is the greatest liberator in human history of the poor, of the 95% who used to be in adjunct poverty. It is the greatest system we have ever come across, and the antagonism towards it I find mystifying, because, again, Human life has never, ever, ever been better than it is right now. And it could be a lot better, that we'll agree on, because I don't think we're capitalist enough. We don't take our capitalism seriously enough. And there's a trick in your question, right? Because you have equated fairness with equality. But fairness never used to mean equality. Fairness means getting what you deserve. And I would argue that equality is not what you deserve. Some people deserve more and some people deserve less based on the value they create.
But how do you define deserve? I mean, suppose you're born with special educational needs and it's very difficult for you to hold down a normal job. Do you just deserve to be poor because, you know, something was a little bit wrong with your brain when you were born?
God. He's a pig. He's such a pig.
So let's flip that around. What makes it because you were born that way? What gives you a claim against what I produce? What gives you a claim about my effort and my values? I might help you.
How much do you think Yaron has produced in his life?
Yeah, no shit, man. Honestly, Yaron, like, he needs a, what is that, a Scrooge, the Christmas tale or whatever the fuck, where
he visited my three ghosts.
I want to see Yaron visit the world where he never existed and see how fucking similar it is. How the exact same guy would be wearing the exact same suits in the exact same chair, saying the exact same shit with maybe a slightly different accent. Like, absolutely produce nothing. The claims on your labor, please. Like, claims on the type of where that money came from. Like, I think the workers probably, like, down the line, you could trace that. I'd be interested in that. I mean, and Ayn Rand is Scoot, that's Cokes. So, like, well done with, like, the biggest, I think, civil lawsuit ever. Anyway, we're not going to get into the Koch brothers stuff, but
and I care about human beings. But what gives you a claim against me and the right to use violence against me in order to fulfill that
claim? I never suggested violence.
Well, taxes. what is redistribution of wealth?
I can't believe she's going to wade into this discourse.
Yeah, I know.
Like it's just like, come on. This is like their favorite thing, man.
This is, yeah, you're not helping. Like, first of all, take his side on everything, and then, yeah, get Panish to check out and then take over as the socialist.
No, Panish is gone. Yeah, Panish is like getting a beer. He's going to be back in a couple minutes.
You know? Try not paying your taxes and see what happens. Of course, it's fine.
No one's going to hurt you. No one's going to hit you.
I have a different response. Well, of course, a different response to
let Leo come back.
The peroration to capitalism you just heard, you can read in the whole first half of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. Right. It is absolutely true, and that's why we're talking about not a model, but historical conflict and direction, movement. Of course, capitalism has been the most dynamic, the most productive, the most competitive, the most successful economic system in human history. The bourgeoisie has been the most revolutionary class in human history, much more than the proletariat, absolutely. And if Marx was wrong, he was wrong in thinking that at a very young age, it didn't have very long to live. The book I've written, The Making of Global Capitalism, is about how remarkable it is that 150 years after the Communist Manifesto, which so brilliantly predicts what we came to call globalization in the 1990s, was realized 150 years later, exactly in the terms we just heard, where every social relationship on the face of the earth is commodified. Wherever social relationship on the face of the earth is treated as a derivative asset. That's the world we're in, and it is dynamic. Very true, right? And it does produce enormous wealth. It also, of course, produces enormous inequality, even when it increases the standard of living of those at the bottom. That's very true. So all of these societies that have become capitalists in this period, above all Nigeria, the notion that Nigeria ever claimed to be socialist, the first thing that National Socialism did was to imprison the trade unionists, the social democrats, let alone the communists. The only reason they took the word socialism was because of the appeal it had to a very strong German working class. The whole emphasis of fascism was anti-socialist, and it's obvious from who didn't go to jail and who did. Who didn't go to jail were the capitalists. That's not who violence was.
I think the Jewish people might disagree.
That's such a nasty thing, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Backinflation. Are you serious? You know, they get pissy with Jeremy Corbyn about stuff. I don't know.
Just ahistorical, too, because, like, of course, 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis. That wasn't the limit of Nazi persecution. And the idea that there was none of political, it's erasing history. So, like, she can have whatever tone she has, but what she's doing is actually pretty disgusting.
Especially the fact that, Panish is Jewish himself, comes from a Jewish family. I don't know about any extent, regarding the Holocaust or something like that, but this kind of cheap point is so nasty.
Really gross.
What I was referring to with the failure of neoliberal globalism,
immature,
was
really
not what you're describing as its capitalist successes. The failures are the delegitimation that has come after 2007, but up to today. The largest number of strikes in the world are in China, by far. 200,000 a year, right? By people whose standards of living have gone up, who support their extended families in the villages, right? That's the largest number of strikes, the largest number of suicides, the largest number of occupational deaths in the world, right? The same is true of India, where there is a massive middle class, absolutely true. But the massive increase in impoverishment, in alienation, in destitution, is enormous, especially in the massive cities, which you're connected with. When you connect with someone in Chennai and you think you're calling up BT and it's actually some educated Indian on the line who is giving you advice about what to do to get your phone fixed. In that very city, which I've been, where 200,000 women have recently organized against Nokia by the National Indian Trade Union Federation, the impoverishment is stunning. It looks like Manchester.
But the point is this. Stunning. It looks like Manchester.
Manchester in 1848.
Compared to where they were 48.
Panage probably should have spelled that out, like what he was talking about, what looks like Manchester with regards to 19th century. But had they any sort of historical background and preparedness for this conversation, that would have been apparent, like when he said it.
I mean, honestly, at this point, and he still keeps hitting some punches, but like honestly, at this point, you can see that they're just trying to see if we can maybe find some common ground. Maybe everybody will giggle and we'll like get off of this train,
right?
You know, it's like honestly, this is much more about like social dynamics between these four people.
Yeah, yeah.
The questions than any thought out critique.
No, I totally agree. I totally agree. That is not to say, therefore, that capitalism is over. What it is to say is that the conflict that capitalism has always produced, the aspirations it's always produced, are not going to go away. But the 21st century will be a century again of socialist movement and aspiration. Whether we will get it right will partly have to do with the degree of dogmatism on the right with regard to giving space to do it. Because they have the military. They have the City of London. And if there is not space given to a democratic socialist government to try to turn finance into a public utility, to try to extend the co-ops you were speaking of, to use the National Investment Bank and regional investment banks to provide an infrastructure for those co-ops, then we could indeed face a dictatorial capitalism. Or if Jeremy Corbyn totally transforms himself as a human being, which I don't think he would, yes, we could face an authoritarian socialism.
We're going to go on to the future in a moment. Hang on a moment, because what I really want to discuss here is which system goes best or against the
great. Oh, come on.
Capitalism makes us feel alienated and dispirited and suicidal.
Human nature is not one thing.
Well, I know it's not one thing, but equally when socialism has been tried in practice, that also seems to go against the grain of human nature, because people seem to want to incentive to work, and therefore, and in collectivized farms and that sort of thing, hardly any food got grown when they got in Cuba, when people were allowed to grow their own food in farms, suddenly production went up. So I'm just wondering whether there's something about human nature that perhaps doesn't work with a collectivized
system. We have to unleash the many dimensions of human nature. The care that a mother shows for her child, the sensitivity we feel to a human being in suffering is part of our human nature.
Yeah, and Brooks check his watch.
That he thinks is the goal of all human life.
Of course not.
Right? But the protection of his property is also human nature. What we need to do is try to develop those aspects of human nature that realize individuality in a social way, not in a selfish, greedy, let me engage in a tax haven way. And say, oh,
I think Yaron lives in Puerto Rico, by the way.
It's a complete and utter caricature. The idea that all human relationships be commoditized. My relationship with my wife and my children is not being commoditized. My relationship with my friends is not being commoditized. My relationship with my social circle, and maybe for some of you, your religion is not being commoditized. The idea that these relationships are being commoditized is just propaganda.
I didn't mean to. Yeah, he's in Puerto Rico. Like he moved there to avoid taxes.
Oh, God.
To make capitalism be what it is not. All capitalism is, and we're going to disagree a little bit about capitalism, and we're certainly going to disagree about what capitalism is.
First of all, the idea that all relationships aren't commodified, like how many times have you seen this, like, I saw this recently. You are who you surround yourself with. Surround yourself with, like, high earners, that's how you become a high earner, right? Like, I mean, every and then you get blame people for not doing that in college,
which is an infection of a capitalist mentality of that kind of mentality of commodifying every aspect of your life that you're considering something that's so genuinely human as friendship and companionship, but you're considering it a kind of transactional way. It's like, okay, well, what am I getting from this?
Yep.
Absolutely, I don't. Yeah, it's a good
capitalism
point.
Capitalism is freedom. Capitalism is the freedom of the individual to live his life as he sees fit, free of coercion. Free of coercion.
Sorry, what are bosses?
Of the state.
Also, somebody made a good point in the chat that I wonder if he signed a prenup for his relationship with his wife.
From his neighbor.
Ask a minder in a Welsh mind.
And free of coercion from the co-op.
Yeah.
It's not what we have today. We don't have capitalism today. We have elements of capitalism. But the reason there's so many strikes in China today is because China...
The fucking gall that they get off on calling Panitch slippery or ephemeral with his debates and then basically make the exact same argument, but that we're as if we're emerging from some sort of totalitarian communist society is ridiculous.
Is not capitalist, but elements, there are elements of capitalism in China, just like there are elements of socialism in China. But what makes China rich, what allows the individuals in China to achieve their human potential and to live up to their human nature, is the capitalist element. It is the socialist element that is actually suppressing them and causing them to strike. It is in the state-run enterprises where you're seeing the strikes. It is not in the private sector that you're seeing the strikes. So it's a perversion to describe capitalism as fascist. Yes, the capitalists, so-called capitalists, the people with money, and not everybody with money is a capitalist. The people with money who wanted to cooperate with the Nazis didn't go to jail. The people with money who didn't want to cooperate with the Nazis did go to jail. To make this about class warfare, fascism, and particularly Nazis, is a complete and utter distortion of history. Certainly there were rich families in Germany who cooperated with the Nazis, and they should go to hell for that. But it is not true that every single person with money was a Nazi, and that money defined their cooperation. Many of them refused.
Who
and
will
many
think
of
the... Camps. Who will think of the rich?
The rich I mean, this is just demonstrable that the Nazis were on the side of business. I mean, there was business that was... would have preferred more moderate, you know, conservatism, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, like, it was the anti...
It was a hammer that struck down the danger of socialism. I mean, yeah. That's the deal.
Hitler was explicit about that.
Might not have been happy about it, right? But they were more than willing to go along with it because they knew that they wanted to win the class war because they knew that all of their power and wealth and material interest went with that, right?
Certainly if they were Jewish, but even if they were not. Fascism is the antithesis of capitalism. Fascism is far more similar to socialism than it is to capitalism. Indeed, at the edges, socialism, communism, and fascism are brothers. Yes, the Nazis got rid of their political enemies, but they imposed the same kind of central planning as the socialists did in Soviet Union. It just had a slightly different form. Both are anti-democratic, both are anti-freedom, and both want to sacrifice the individual to some grand view of humanity, whether it's for the sake of the proletarian, the working classes, or for the sake of the
Just to say this, like this point about incompatible with democracy. The whole point about capitalism is, say that hydroelectric dam that's private now, that means it's not under democratic control when it once was, at least nominally. So that's where capitalism fundamentally, if we're talking about things that are not compatible with democracy, it's capitalism.
But let me make one other point about spiritual values or whatever. I mean, when I look at the 19th
century,
and I look at somebody like Beethoven, who was born, if you will, under a feudal system and it grew up into a more capitalist system, I see an artist going from a position where he was completely 100% dependent on aristocrats for being able to create his music and put on performances. By the end of his career, he's doing live events, public events, where the new bourgeoisie are paying to come and see him perform. And what you see throughout Europe is a flourishing of self-expression, a flourishing of the arts, a flourishing of diverse, a massive diversity, artistic, spiritual, ideological, wonderful debates and discussions and salons.
And that beautiful, and the throne that they're sitting on is built off of silver extracted by force and turning South America into an open pit mine. I mean, it's just, it's so incredible to talk about the influx in like wealth and opulence of that period of time,
right?
You know, beneficial as it might have been for European people, right? And to the arts and things like that. That he's saying,
and all these people had cotton clothes that were really nice and cheap. Imagine,
yeah, exactly. I wonder how that came about, right? And it's like, you know, we recognize the historical arguments about capitalism eradicating, you know, more, you know, systems like feudalism and recognize as a whole a positive thing.
They just took the mantle. They took the power from the king of deciding. That's what changed.
It wasn't a replacement of the bloody wheels of history. It was, and in a lot of places and for a lot of people, an acceleration of it.
Right.
And the abilities to recognize, like, you know, production and trade in that way meant more and more people were crushed and lost their lives and lost their homes by the system. So I don't know. It's amazing to sit here and talk about, you know, beautiful things were in Europe at this period of time when there's like a very, very clear pipeline of like sorrow and misery in the rest of the world and plunder and gold, you know, coming into Europe.
Yeah, it's just weaponizing the idea that it's tough for people to think about these things historically situated and in the world. Like,
because we're not taught to think that way.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why this whole debate is so absurd.
And that they are now accessible to the masses.
Hardly.
Kenny.
In the 19th century?
No, that can't be.
By the end of the 19th.
Well, thank you, Marianne. I mean, I think for me, a really poignant moment in this discussion has been, it's what Yaron just touched on, but Leo saying that the capitalists cooperated with the Nazis and then completely forgetting what happened to the Jews whose property was confiscated and what happened to them. And it resonates for me now.
Oh. When we talk about this is the fucking British Conservative Party, though. I mean, this is what they do, is just weaponize, you know, history and other people's pain to defend, you know, to defend, one, this historical system that has been the engine and immiserated so many, many people, but specifically in the British case, to defend a social class, an economic class that has been the architects of this stuff, and to just put nasty slice like that on Leo Panitch is so despicable. When you spend your entire life making excuses for a ruling class that has just done unspeakable horrors on the rest of the world, that you're now going to sit here and throw mud at somebody like Leo Panitch about the Nazis trying to, you know, conflate, you know, it's really despicable.
Yeah. What was the Tories' position on Hitler? Was that always something you wanted to publicize? Is that something we want to remember?
God. I think it's actually linked to linking capitalism and being Jewish. There's something about that link that's coming up, and then the anti-Semitism in its own way is an anti-capitalist expression that's come out in a particularly ugly form.
Like that mural that Jeremy Corbyn approved of.
Well, I'm not even sure he really understands exactly what is going on.
Not like she does.
Some people think that he understands.
You think I said something that didn't refer?
No. I think that we get these.
Excuse me.
No, Leo. Listen to what I'm saying. Let me. You've had your chance. There are blank spots which people tend to have when they're talking about socialism and capitalism. They see the very best in their own motivations and opinions, and the very worst in their opponents.
This is just that same shit.
Bad things which have happened by people on their own side. And it's interesting, you know, talking to me about Nigerian capitalism, this myth of Nigerian capitalism, it really saddens me because I lived it, I grew up in it. I went to a school, for example, where you had to take exams.
By the way, she's like a super well-off person who lived all over.
These are the subjects you're going to study. You pass.
It was known as the 11 plus here in Britain.
No, nothing like that at all. It's not the 11 plus. This is about if you score above a certain amount, you've got to do sciences. And it's why, for instance, you find more African and Asian women in engineering courses. I studied engineering because it's all state, it's state designed. I had an exam which was similar to the 11 plus. And what they did was they took all the scores of everyone who was there and who took the exam, and they sprinkled us around the country because they wanted us to be equal. They didn't want us to go to the school that was nearest home. They wanted everybody to understand what it was like in a different part of the country. So can you imagine?
Leo's like, damn, this is socialism.
Going to send you to a school 500 miles from home. State boarding school, it had to be. We had to do manual labor so that we could learn about these values, these social values, learn about the land. Because people go there and they see markets and people buying and selling, and they call it capitalism. The state defines how much the currency is worth. So you can't buy foreign exchange, for instance. So a black market is created where the real value of the money exists. And if someone like my mother or father wants to come to this country, she buys, if she wants if she wants it quickly, she buys it off the black market. If she wants it at the official rate, she goes to a bank and she writes for permission to change her own money at a rate that is viable. That is what the wealthy people do. It always fosters corruption. But people don't understand this. They confuse the ability of someone to be able to sell trinkets and maybe set up a business as capitalism when the entire structure is actually about state control.
It's about
state intervention and telling people what they should do and how they live their lives. You can't do anything on your own.
I think
without
you make my
permission.
Point. That capitalism as a real historical system has existed far more with dictatorial governments than it has with what we call democratic ones.
Capitalism is about individual liberty. So
the thing about inviting a Tory politician to something like this is she can't not disagree with that. I guess none of these people can actually like change it, but it's just like it's weird having a politician. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's true.
By definition, a dictatorial country is not a capitalist country.
In fact, I think what it is is that dictatorships are so common that you will find capitalism in dictatorships. You'll find socialism in dictatorships. But when you look.
Just like, I can't. The idea, like, okay, like, get specific. Like, if you know all this, if you can educate Leo about dictators and, oh, there might be some capitalism among some dictators. Like, but this is all just. Like, it's really frustrating. It's because it's just received knowledge.
Yeah, this is the rage part.
Look at the impact on other people's lives. When you look at the bare facts of, do people want to live in these socialist states? No, they don't. You can't argue against that.
I think it is just an objective fact, and I'm not taking sides here, that there are more democracies that are capitalist than democracies that are socialist. But Leo, because you're the only socialist on the platform, I'm going to give you 5 minutes now to tell us how you would make socialism
actually... There is not a political...
Finish my question to you. I'm the chair. Thank you. I will give you 3 or 4 minutes.
Oh, shut up.
Exactly how you put socialism in action... Retaining all the democratic freedom of expression, that sort of thing, in a way that would work in a country like the UK.
Good. The democracy that we enjoy, the very limited democracy that we enjoy in the advanced capitalist societies, and political scientists of every ideological stripe agree with this, cannot be understood apart from the formation of organizations of the unpropertied who demanded that they be included in the state despite being unpropertied. The form of elected representation we had before Jacksonian democracy in the United States, first of all,
I don't want any history, so you only got three minutes.
She just said she's going to give him 5 minutes. Now it's only 3 minutes and she doesn't want to get history.
Corbyn, what would you do?
Well, I think this is related to it. It was the development of labor movements and the development of feminist movements after that, supported usually by these labor movements, arguing that the unpropertied or human beings were considered the properties of the men and their family, should be able to be members of the state. And the democracy we have, which is a real, valued, and important thing, was won by those struggles. It didn't come out of an abstract model. It didn't come out of the beneficence of the old state ruling class. It was won everywhere, and this is entirely agreed in political science. There was a great deal of socialist...
I wonder why Brooks is shaping his head. Like, what, was it just capitalists decided they wanted all their workers?
Like, to put it in philosophical terms, he's an idealist, right? He thinks that, like, we have the correct texts, and then those, you know, went into the society and, you know, caused this explosion. Rather than Leo Panitch having, you know, materialist and, in my opinion, correct view, that these things developed out of actually existing people, actually existing communities. I'm sorry. You know, Yarn is going to go off on some nonsense as his, like, slam dunk at the end of this, right? It was like, you know, look at the United States. It's like a classic understanding that people recognize now that from the very beginning of our founding documents, there was an incredible tension and contradiction from documents that said that they believe in universal ideas of human rights and equality, when you had millions of people in human bondage, when you had people who didn't have property, not only were they subjected to a lot of nonsense, they weren't even seen as citizens in the same sense that they were able to vote, right? So to activate and to win these things came out of actual social struggle, not the documents themselves, because they had the documents at the beginning and it didn't come from that, right? It, you know, and this is the point, and this is why I find Panitch to be such a great speaker and teacher of these points, is because he really, because a lot of people say, like, okay, you have to understand history and all these things, but he really does lay these things out clearly for people, saying you have to understand these are social processes and not just something that's coming from up high, which is what the moderator's trying to make him say. And, you know, whatever, like, you know, you can maybe even say, like, okay, maybe you might think that is slippery or whatever, but you have to let them articulate that point. You can't tell somebody who is a materialist, somebody who's talking, who's recognizing that these things come out of history, come out of social relations and all these things, and then force them to have, like, okay, here's my prognosis of the 10 things that, you know, we need to do in government to implement socialism, right? It's just, it's absurd to do that. And it's not, like, intellectually curious at all.
Yeah. It's really, this is more infuriating than I was prepared for.
Yearning often associated with this, but not for the most part. That socialist yearning, that yearning for collective protection, collective expression, an attempt to democratize our society, to democratize the enterprise, to allow what happens on the hospital ward to be a matter of discourse and discussion of a democratic kind, to allow what happens in the mine to be that, was what people were also seeking for. That has not been achieved.
Couldn't pick that up.
Well, we have a free national health service here, which is free.
This is not what I taught. I was speaking of the democratic aspiration. What we have is a society in which the decisions about what is to be produced, where it's to be produced, what's to be invested, how it's to be invested, is not determined by states. It is determined by the massive corporations that control the economies. They do so, of course, in close conjunction with the states that protect their property, that codify the rules of exchange around the world.
So you've got 1 minute to tell us what you would do as Prime Minister.
We have a bit of important democracy, but we have a yearning,
exactly, fucking stupid kind of question is that,
for a much broader, a much deeper democratic economy, democratic society.
This gotcha of the what would you, an individual, do about socialism is amazing. I mean, yeah, hopefully we can do some work against that, because that's just ridiculous.
What socialism means.
What's it actually involve? What do you do?
Well, if you
that?
Read the Labor Manifesto, it begins with developing the co-op system, providing an infrastructure through it for it through regional investment banks. In my view, eventually, although this would meet enormous opposition, not only from the City of London, but I fear from parts of the British state, which are the repressive apparatus of the state, to turn what we all need so badly and are now so stuck into, to turn the City of London into a public utility. This is what all of our resources pass through, right? And without access to that, we can't democratically decide what should be produced, how it should be produced, whether the NHS should be marketized, which is what's happened to it. I'll stop
there. Right. Good. So I'd like to thank our panelists very much, and you as well, for coming.
There we go. Thank God.
Yeah, that's tough. But, I mean, you know, he's ready to meet the challenge. But, again, like, you know, the reason he brings up that public investment and, like, taking over the City of London at the end there is because it's really important that you don't separate those things from social struggle that's necessary to produce them. Like, this is one of the things that, like, they're trying to get him to do, and it's also a mistake that a lot of socialists and leftists think. Right, that if they can just come up with the perfect, you know, policy, then it's going to work. It's like, no, we know, like he knows right now that you have to turn the financial system, right, into a public utility, because that controls so much of our ability to invest. It controls production, right? To do anything, you have to have control of that. But he doesn't just want to say it in the sense of, like, as some kind of throwaway line, because to do that is going to be met with resistance and all these other things. Like, to say one thing without the other, the mechanism for how you're going to get there, it's critical to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe how reminiscent it is of the Richard Wolff Destiny debate, really. Basically the exact same shit. Simultaneously completely understanding that, like, capitalism can exist within the context of something you don't consider capitalism, but asking where socialism exists. Like,
I mean, it's extremely unhelpful, because you can either take, like, the Panitch or the Wolf route, which is probably the correct one, right, to just continue to try to make your point. Or you can do what some other people would do, would be, you know, to argue about the benefits of a system like they have in Cuba or in Vietnam, which is always surprisingly, by the way, left out of these discussions, I feel, right? Obviously, it's not China or India or
Cuba, yeah,
which is a very famous example, but that's a pretty historical country that has a unique model. Again, I think that it would be unhelpful to say, you know, Vietnam is socialist in the sense of, like, this is a model, but there's developments there. There are things that are very interesting in that society, right? But then if you take that route, then you fall into a trap of having to defend everything that the state in Vietnam is doing, which would be incorrect position as a socialist to take, and also would just be exhausting, because you would never get to the crux of the matter. I don't know. The debate's interesting, though. What do you think, Matt?
I thought it was. Like, I think Panitch is great, and I thought when he was able to get rolling outside of being harassed by, chicken shit, squabble stuff, I thought it was very informative. And I also am a person who likes occasionally checking in with just what the songs the other team's playing, and it's always the same fucking stuff. But there's something kind of a bit reassuring about that, because I don't think that, like, that whole thing of, I think it just says a whole lot about how Leo forgot about the Jews and the Holocaust. Like,
what the fuck is the accusation there?
I mean, that is remarkable to see that, especially in light of, like, how we're seeing that sort of line.
I mean, but that became such a great well.
Yeah.
For the right wing to dive into, and, you know, it still obviously exists today, yeah. But you could see certainly the conditions, and man, it's sometimes sad to think though, you know, that at that moment we're even looking at, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, movements within the Labour Party. I think that that's a good point. It's like you have to see the song that they're singing, and also recognize that Panish also took that debate in a very different direction that a lot of other socialist debaters would do either.
And I really like that too. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, especially now when we're trying to do all this work and, you know, we're having arguments with people who, you know, mighty close to the Labour Party, you know, like in the Navarre media crowd, who have been doing all this BS praising Biden because his plan is bigger, right? And I think that that's, we, you know, people who watch this show know we very much disagree with that kind of conception in that kind of Panitch a way of thinking about what socialism is. And we're finding out, by the way, now, a few months in,
right,
it's been complete bullshit.
Surprise.
A lot of people should spend a little bit of time, you know, dealing with that. But I bring that up because that's why Panitch is so interesting and important for people to deal with today, because he is looking at these questions in this historical way that even though, like, the political scene is different from even in 2021 from 2018, right? The questions that are being asked, how we're dealing with it. But I think it's important to realize, oh, this model still is able to speak today as it was then. Probably has some very serious legs.
Yeah. All right, folks. We'll be back. Enjoy the rest of the week. I'm going to go enjoy basketball. That's what I'm curious about.
Good.
See the scores. But yeah, and we'll see you on Thursday. Anything to plug for you, David?
I'll be jumping on tomorrow. I think about, say, 4 Central. I might change that, but that's what I'm feeling right now.
All right, cool. You heard him, folks. We will see you then.